This is Erin Blanning, and today for People Science, I'm talking to Georgia Siemens about her research and these interesting times we're living in. So thanks so much for joining me today.
Hi, Erin. Thanks so much for having me.
Awesome. So I'm wondering if, just to get started, you could tell us about your research and your work and what impact you hope your research has on your field.
Okay, well, I guess I'll answer this in two parts. So my field is urban forestry. And in that respect, if we're talking about the research aspects of that, I published two articles about urban plants. They're published in academic journals, and they've both been cited. The first article was based on my dissertation work looking at the changing discourse around street trees in planning and policy at the municipal and nonprofit level in a few California cities. And that was, I was looking between the time frame of the 1980s to the early 2000s. I'm proud to say that article has been cited 100 times. I actually don't know what the impact of that really is in the academic space, because I'm not a practicing academic. And the second academic publication I have is also about plants. And I was looking at the small data that artists and landscape designers were collecting around spontaneous urban vegetation. That one has definitely been cited less. It's only been cited once. But I know there's a really active community of both practitioners and academics looking at spontaneous urban vegetation. It's probably more accurate to describe my current work as urban ecology education. I am the director of Washington Square Park EcoProjects here in New York City, and I co-founded the initiative in 2013-2014. The mission of EcoProjects, there are three goals that we have: to monitor the biodiversity in the park. Specifically, we have a big focus on birds and trees. We also develop programs that offer passive and active education and community science opportunities. And the third piece of the work that we do is to advocate for an more ecologically healthy landscape. So that really boils down to making sure that the selection of trees, both large and small, shrub, the herbaceous layer, are really going to support as many non-human animals as possible. As part of the work with EcoProjects, we do have two research-oriented projects. One is a bi-monthly wildlife survey, and we started that in the summer of 2016. And just for clarity's sake, when we say wildlife, we're really just looking at birds and other things like squirrels, rats, and mice. We don't have any larger non-human animals in the park. And the second research project that we have going on is a plant phenology monitoring program. And we launched that in September of 2019. And in both cases, what we're trying to do is to create a baseline data set, because none exists for this park. And we're then hopeful that in partnership with researchers, that we can use the data we're collecting to answer research questions that are either descriptive or predictive.
Wow, that's all really cool. It's exciting to hear you talk about it, because just nature, I feel like it doesn't get enough attention. So I'm wondering, what impact have COVID-19 and the Black Lives Matter movement possibly had on, you know, your work and your research?
Boy, I think both those things are ongoing and have definitely impacted, and both have definitely impacted my personal life and professional work, and they've done so in different ways. So New York State, as you know, had issued a stay-at-home order in the middle of March. And with that, like with other organizations in the city, our work was halted. So we and our monitoring volunteers stopped going to the park to collect data. Though as the severity of the situation eased off, my colleague and I began to slowly do the wildlife surveys again. And I've really focused on the phenology monitoring work. We haven't hosted any public programs yet, and I'm trying to pivot. So one of our programs is the Explore Birds Education Program. It is a public space program where we bring bird specimens out, and pre-pandemic folks were encouraged to touch them. There was a reading component, there was an art component, there was a listening component. But because of the circumstances of the pandemic, we haven't been able to offer that program in person. And so we're trying to pivot to an online format, and we're hoping to do a soft launch of that later this month. And then fingers crossed, we can bring the bird specimens and the full program back to parks and plazas this fall. You know, the bird component of the work that we've done is really significant for the park because it's really put Washington Square Park on the map as a place where you can see interesting birds. And so I'm really excited to be able to engage with the park and with the public around birds again. The Black Lives Matter movement, since this is a podcast, folks might not know I'm a Black woman, and the movement has been incredibly meaningful for me, and I live in Greenwich Village, and Washington Square Park was the site of many, many protests. I'm also adjacent to Soho, which was also the site of a lot of uprising activity and a lot of really fantastic protest art. And so the visibility of both protests and the uprising have made conversations with my children more tangible. It's sort of easier, I find it easier to talk about race in America because you can, it's so visible. You can see it in the landscape. It's not something that's abstract anymore. And on a professional level, seeing the park as a public square again, in the sense that a square is a place for the public to gather in large numbers freely to protest inequity and injustice, was deeply, deeply inspiring. Despite the harsh and brutal reasons for behind the protest movement, I don't know, I was filled with such joy at seeing so many, many Black people and other people of color in the park. And the movement has really refocused me on this idea that I've been playing around with for a couple years around the ecology of small parks, or the role that small parks can play in a city's ecological health. And I'm considering Washington Square Park a small park because it's 10 acres. And the work that I'm hoping to do is really to focus on neighborhoods whose small parks have been historically neglected, and to think about the ways in which we can spotlight them as places for habitat and the benefits that humans receive because of spending time in those kinds of places.
One thing that excites me about the movement happening today is that it's just affected everyone in so many different ways. And, you know, Black Lives Matter has become part of the conversation in so many different areas. And so I'm wondering, what excites you most about the uprising happening today?
Many, many things. So I see it as shining a really bright light on the legacy of Black people, Indigenous people, people of color, and environmental justice and equity work. So the uprising is not this kind of spur of the moment movement. It's something that has a long history in what we call the United States. And today's uprising, I mean, really highlights that history of people of color and their stewardship of both land and water. I keep coming back to this thing of joy because it's something that one of the co-organizers of Black Botanist Week, of which I am one, brought up, that it's so wonderful to see Black people, joyous Black people, in nature. And that's one of the things that the uprising showcases, is that despite the bodily harm that has come to Black people from spending time in nature, we still pursue our happiness in natural spaces. And we've just seen many images of that to counter some of the deep harm that comes to people of color. And it's also, the movement has also, I think, foregrounded both the academic work and the applied work that Black people do in conservation writ large. So mainstream environmental conservation looks white. And I think what the uprising is showing is that, yes, it is white. Yes, these organizations need to make room for non-white folks, but it's also showing us that there are Black people out there who are doing this work and who have a lot of experience, and we should take this opportunity to raise them up and to bring along the next generation of folks. Because the uprising and the issues of justice, I think, are also tied to, you know, the places where you live, that's your environment, where you work, that's your environment, that's the backbone of the environmental justice movement. And so we can't think of it any longer as just, oh, the national park that I might go to once a month. It's where you live, and people have real knowledge about the places they live, and that knowledge needs to be a part of the conversation and the decision-making process. And I guess finally, I am uplifted by the energy and charisma of the young people involved in the uprising. I think their advocacy work is really great, and you can see that changes are happening now. And I think in order to sustain momentum, it's really important to see change happening all along that pathway. And the strategies that folks in the movement have undertaken are really smart. And so I think, you know, it looks like it'll be sustainable. People remain interested, they remain active, and they continue to fight for justice.
Yeah, I think I've also been excited by just seeing how, you know, it's moving towards a sustained effort, which is really great. And so thinking more about, like, you know, structural things and that sort of stuff, what do you think is the first step in making your field more welcoming to people of color?
Okay, so I would then define my field, sort of the big box of urban ecology under which is the field I was trained in, which is urban forestry. So the first thing I would say is that ease of entry matters. So thinking about what barriers or challenges exist to entering the field of urban ecology, you know, like, do people see themselves represented in the profession? That's really important. Do the people employed in the industry or institution actually look like you? Not just in terms of race and ethnicity, but also socioeconomic background, where did they go to college, where did they grow up? All of these factors of representation are really important, and making those sets of things really diverse and reflective of the general population. And then, is that representation substantive or token? No one wants to be the token person in a space. And you're only going to get a truly diverse workplace if representation is substantive. You can't sustain diversity, equity, and inclusion without that substantive piece. But even before you get to the workplace, things to think about is it a field that you've even heard of, or does it seem relevant to your interests? Do you actually know anyone who's in that field? Is the aesthetic of the field something that's totally inaccessible to you? I remember listening to a conversation. It might have been during Black Hikers Week or Black Birders Week. No, I remember it was during Black Botanist Week. And Maya Allen was on a Instagram exchange with someone from the University of New Mexico. And they were talking about the gear that you need when you do outdoor field work. And if that's not part of your vernacular, that can be a barrier to entry. And another piece of that is, are there opportunities for you to develop the skill sets and or the formal education to enter the field of urban ecology, urban forestry? I think getting these things into the K through 12 system as a course of study is really important. Urban ecology checks a lot of boxes. It includes math and science and engineering and art and written and verbal communication and so much more. And it's a real opportunity for urban ecology and allied fields to be providing skill development opportunities for school-aged children in the communities where they work. I think it's their responsibility and obligation to do so. I mean, young people don't start on their career paths when they get to college. They start in high school. And urban forestry and urban ecology practitioners and academics should definitely be promoting their work and their profession to high school age Black and Indigenous and people and students of color, and not only promoting their work, but getting their work as a subject area of study in the K through 12 system. And if that's not feasible in the short term, it should still be a long-term goal, but shorter term goals might be developing programs that are after school, weekend and summer opportunities that are not busy work, but actually develop marketable skills.
Awesome. I think those are all really amazing steps that should be taken, you know, in the future to make sure that everything's a little more equitable. And so I'm wondering, kind of along the same lines, what advice could you give a young person of color navigating urban forestry?
Advice. I would say maybe one of the first steps is to find a mentor of color, someone who you feel is most similar to you as a person. And although our numbers in organizations and institutions and companies and universities are well below where they should be, we're out there. And the pandemic situation, and hopefully this aspect of the pandemic will last, I think have made people even more open to mentoring and to shepherding and to providing guidance and to networking and connecting. And I would say, don't overlook the people in your communities. People in your community doing environmental work, broadly speaking, might have bridging ties to organizations and agencies that you see yourself or dream of working in. So don't overlook local folks. And for the social media savvy of you out there, use social media to communicate with Black and people of color in your areas of interest. Lots of folks are online and it's so easy to reach out to people using social media. Another piece of advice I would say, and this is something I've come to only in the last few years, is to say yes to as many opportunities as you can. Don't assume that you won't get that opportunity. So don't preemptively say no. Say yes. Go for it. If these opportunities don't come with a wage, ask for one. You're providing skills, you're providing knowledge, and you should be compensated for it. And any opportunity that comes your way, you should use it to build and diversify your skill set. Learn how to do as many aspects of that job or profession as possible. You know, data analysis and communication are really incredibly valuable. And if you're versed in both or either of those areas, there are a lot of job and career opportunities open to you. If you're more comfortable with field work, you don't want to be in an office, pursue opportunities that get you outdoors. Maybe you don't know which one you like, so do both and figure it out through experience. And maybe the last piece is to promote yourself. So I forget my generation, but I've noticed that the younger than me generations are really savvy in terms of self-promotion. They really know how to highlight the work that they're doing. And I would say use whatever tech is available to you, or use the tech that you feel most comfortable using, and spread the word about what you're already doing and what you'd like to do. So get involved in these online communities and online conversations so people see what your value and contributions are. And if you don't have all the tools you need to start something, find a friend to collaborate with. When I kicked off Eco Projects in 2013-2014, I collaborated with an acquaintance. And she cycled off, and I knew I wanted to include bird work as part of the initiative. And so I reached out to a friend who is an experienced birder and grew that aspect of the organization. Now, one of my advisors once said to me, don't let perfection be the enemy of the good. And I would say, don't let perfection be the enemy of starting your initiative. Whether you start small or big or anywhere in between, launch yourself. You will find that there are people out there who share your interests and who want to amplify and support your work.
Wow. Thank you so much for sharing all that advice. That sounds really great. And I'm wondering, is there anything else that I maybe haven't asked that you would like to share?
Sure. I wanted to come back to the sort of piece I was talking about, the ecology of small parks, and I wanted to tether that to the Explore Birds Education Program, which I also mentioned. So pre-pandemic, we were doing a lot of pop-ups in collaboration with another organization whose name is Street Lab, and we didn't take any formal measurements of impact, but whenever we popped up in parks or plazas, there was a lot of interest and participation. And I think in part bringing nature, whether you bring it in its whole form, which is pretty hard to do, or in part the way we were doing through this pop-up education program, bringing it to where people are is incredibly important. So we know, and researchers have quantified the socio-emotional and physiological benefits of nature to humans. And spending time in and interacting with nature also promotes pro-environmental behaviors, and it just makes it more important for people and nature to be more proximate to each other. And this is part of the work I'm doing, not necessarily through eco projects, but separately in a different box of my professional life, is really pushing for nearby nature. So nature people can access every day within comfortable walking distance, high quality nature that supports a diversity of non-human animals, because there's also research that says a biodiverse landscape is really good for people too.
This is Erin Blanding for People Science, and today I've talked with Georgia Silvera Siemens about research in these interesting times we're living in.